If you've got a Bible, you can go ahead and open to Deuteronomy chapter 9. The whole book of Deuteronomy is happening just before God's people experience success for the first time. All of their living memory, they've been either slaves in Egypt or exiles wandering around in the desert. And now comes this moment where they're about to win a little bit. They're going to get to go in and take over a good land and dwell there and experience prosperity. And Moses, who's been leading God's people for 40 years now, he's trying to prepare them to do this well, to receive well the dangerous blessing of success. And in chapter 9 and the first half of chapter 10, he gives them, by way of preparation, he gives them a clarification and a reminder. He clarifies something and he reminds them of something. And that's kind of where we're going with the sermon this morning. So the first thing that Moses gives them is this clarification. And what he's clarifying is he wants God's people to grasp that just because them are the bad guys doesn't mean we are the good guys. They're about to go into this war against the people who are dwelling in the promised land. And these people who are dwelling there, they are not good people. They have been engaged for hundreds of years in astounding wickedness, and God's going to drive them out. But Moses wants to make sure the people understand, just because the Canaanites are wicked does not mean you are righteous. Being against the villains does not make you the heroes. So listen to verses 1 to 6 of chapter 9. Hear, O Israel, that's God's people, you are to cross over the Jordan River today to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you, cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know and of whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak? Know therefore today that he who goes over before you as a consuming fire is Yahweh your God. He will destroy them and subdue them before you, so you shall drive them out and make them perish quickly, as Yahweh has promised you. Do not say in your heart, after Yahweh your God has thrust them out before you, it is because of my righteousness that Yahweh has brought me in to possess this land. Whereas it is because of the wickedness of these nations that Yahweh is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations, Yahweh your God is driving them out from before you, and that he may confirm the word that Yahweh swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So on the one hand, God's very clear that the people who are going to be driven out are bad guys. They're not just different from us. They're genuinely wicked. But on the other hand, Moses is at pains to clarify, that doesn't make us the good guys. This isn't us-them reality. And them really are wicked. But that doesn't mean we are righteous. He says so repeatedly, as if he's really trying to drive the point home. This is, in my experience, not hard to illustrate. If you grew up with siblings, or if you've had the blessing of having multiple children, you know over and over and over again firsthand the experience of, but what they did was wrong. My brother sinned against me, therefore it doesn't matter whether I sinned against my brother. If he's bad and we disagree, I must be good. This is sort of basic sinner logic. But I do want to notice that here, that logic is not being applied to a squabble between siblings. It's being applied on the level of a whole people, a whole culture. So a better analogy for us might be, we live in the midst of a culture that has completely lost its mind on questions of sex and sexuality. The only real debate is whether it's more insane or more wicked, our sort of everything goes, just feel good and fulfill yourself approach. The damage that it does in any number of arenas, right? And I could go on and on and on about it and just tell you the truth about how terrible it is for minutes or hours or probably days if I had enough stamina. And Moses' point here is not that I'd be wrong. His point is that none of it would make me or us righteous. Disagreeing with a twisted and wicked culture around us does not prevent us from being twisted and wicked. The fact that what's out there is evil and we differentiate ourselves from it doesn't make us good. That's the clarification that Moses is driving home. He's saying to God's people, you have real enemies, and they are really bad. Don't get confused and reason backwards and go, therefore we are really good. We are the righteous ones who see this clearly and act it out perfectly. Being the bad guys does not make us the good guys. God is not with you because you are righteous. He is with you because you need him to make you righteous. That's what Moses is trying to clarify. And he goes from there, from that clarification, to a reminder. I'm not going to read all of the text, but we'll just get started continuing in chapter 9. Know, therefore, that Yahweh your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, in case you didn't get the message the first couple of times, for you are a stubborn people. Remember and do not forget Yahweh. So here Moses is doing something strange. He's speaking to the people, and he's saying, you know, let's be clear. You're going to go in. You're going to take the land from these wicked, not wicked. And then he starts describing the sins that God's people committed 40 years ago. He launches into the kind of the story of all the rebellions of God's people against God, focusing especially on the story of the golden calf, this moment where just after God has miraculously delivered his people from slavery in Egypt and brought them out into the desert and caused water to flow from the rock to keep them from dying of thirst and provided manna from heaven to keep them from dying of starvation. And then they come to Mount Sinai and Moses goes up on the mountain and communes with God on what is basically the top of this volcano, receiving the word of God in a way no one in history has ever received it before, and God's people are down at the bottom, rebelling against him, forgetting everything he's done to provide for them and protect him, and going their own way. And I'm not today going to take the time to kind of unpack all that's going on with the story of the golden calf. I'll just say that it is the biblical blueprint for how a community sins. If Adam and Eve in the garden is the sort of the roadmap for individual sin, for personal rebellion against God, the story of the golden calf is the roadmap for institutional sin, for corporate rebellion against God. It's a how to turn your back on God in 40 days or less. And Moses kind of goes on about it in Deuteronomy 9, really hammering this point home of how wicked it was. And then he describes some of the other sins that God's people committed 40 years ago in the desert. He's trying to, like, this is the pattern of rebellion. This is the way you have been. You are a stubborn people. And the question is, why does he do this? Why take 30 verses to say, hey, remember, 4 decades ago, you were really, really bad? Especially because most of the people there weren't even alive during the golden calf incident. And those who were little kids. What is the invitation that Moses is issuing? What kind of response is he trying to evoke by sort of retelling the history of the sins of God's people? I grew up in North Carolina in the 80s and 90s. And so my childhood experience is I would respond to something like this actually with pride. So I grew up in Chapel Hill, which is like the Corvallis of North Carolina, this sort of like highly educated, progressive enclave in the midst of the South. And if you think of my childhood in the 80s and 90s and you think of the sins of the South 40 years before that, you don't have to think real hard, right? We're talking about violent segregation. Right? And this was a subject I learned a lot about in school. Right? But I learned about it from the perspective of, isn't it terrible what our grandparents did? And isn't it great that we're doing better? I think one of the easiest places is with the sins of our parents and grandparents. Isn't it wonderful that we're not like them? Aren't we going to keep doing better than them? Which is why I think Moses doesn't start this reminder of the sins of the past until he clarifies today, God is not on your side because you are righteous. I want you to be very sure of this, that you don't stand out from the wickedness of other people. So don't remember the sins of your history as things you're different from. Remember the sins of your history as describing what sort of people you still are. The form of rebellion may have changed, but the stubborn heart is the same. Whatever your personal or corporate history is, don't read it and be pleased with yourselves for how much progress you've made. That's clearly not the response that Moses is inviting of the people. On the other hand, Moses is also not inviting a response of shame. Another natural thing to do with a long, blunt, detailed story of how messed up the people have been would be to go, gosh, we really are messed up. How horrible and worthless are we? And be consumed with shame. But that is clearly not what Moses is doing, because Moses draws a distinction between the sinful people and their sin in his telling of the story. So listen to the difference between how Moses treats the people who have rebelled and how he treats the fruit of their rebellion. So picking it up in verse 21 tells us how Moses treats the sin, right? He says, then I took the sinful thing, which was this golden statue of a cow that you had made, and I burned it with fire and crushed it, grinding it very small until it was fine as dust, and I threw the dust of it into the brook that ran down from the mountain. He takes the sin, no matter how beautiful or valuable, a life-size cow made out of gold would be, and just demolishes it. Shows it nothing but hatred and opposition. He sets out to kill the sin. Treat it as worthless, as having no redeeming value. And in doing this, if we read the whole text, it's very clear he's seeing the sin of the people the way God sees the sin of the people. God is furious with the sin. But right before and right after verse 21, Moses prays for the sinners. Verse 20 ends with Moses praying for Aaron, the man who he had left in charge, his brother, who was supposed to kind of keep the people in line while he was on the top of the mountain and completely fumbled it, and then when he got caught, blame shifted. And Moses intercedes for Aaron and asks God to bless Aaron. And then if you go down a few verses, Moses, after he's describing other ways that the people rebelled, starting in verse 25, it says, "So I lay prostrate, lay flat on the ground before Yahweh for 40 days and 40 nights, because Yahweh had said he would destroy you, and I prayed to Yahweh. O Yahweh God, do not destroy your people and your heritage, whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand." You see, Moses absolutely hates the sin, and he does everything he can to save the sinners. He sees this clear distinction between the people and their sin. And this is so, so important. God hates your sin far more than you do. He is far angrier about your sin than you have ever been. And yet he deems you worth saving. So there's this hard line, this unbreakable barrier in the mind of God between guilt for the sins you have committed and shame, a sense of you being worthless. He says your guilt is real. More real than you know. And it is not in my mind, and I never intend for it in your mind to lead to shame. Because knowing how guilty you are, I still find you worth saving. So this long listing of the sins of the people, this exposing of our stubborn hearts, is not meant to make us ashamed. What it's meant to do is invite us to confess, to be a people who are in the habit of naming and acknowledging and remembering our guilt. Confessing aloud to God and to one another our sins. That's the story that Moses is telling. Here's all your guilt so far. Don't forget it. Keep on adding to the story. He invites us to become a confessing people. That's what this is about. And he does it because confession sets us free and because confession makes us holy. Those are the reasons for this invitation to become a confessing people. Confession makes us free. So if I did read all of chapter 9 and the first 11 verses of chapter 10, a lot of it is, here's what you're guilty of. You know that moment for a second you started to think, maybe I'm kind of righteous? No. don't get confused. And he does all of that in between the promise of God's faithfulness and care. Right? Our passage started at the beginning of chapter 9 with, remember, God is bringing you into the promised land. He's going to bless you. He stayed with you through all of this rebellion in the wilderness. And then it ends. In chapter 10, verses 10 and 11, Moses says, I myself stayed on the mountain as at the first time, 40 days and 40 nights, and Yahweh listened to me that time also, and Yahweh was unwilling to destroy you. And Yahweh said to me, arise, go on your journey at the head of the people so that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Right? All of this confession is bracketed, is framed, is contained by God's going to take care of you. He's going to stay with you. Not because you're more righteous than the people in the land, not because you're more righteous than your parents and your grandparents, but because God is faithful. And that frame frees us to confess, frees us to give up on the choice, the false choice between pride and shame. Because they just stop mattering. I don't know exactly how your minds and souls work, but if you could describe my soul as basically a house with two wings, you know, like the White House has the West Wing and the East Wing, right? The house of my soul has the shame wing and the pride wing. And basically everything that I can remember having done or said is furniture in one wing or the other. And every day is an invitation, it feels like, to add to one wing or the other, right? So the wing of my shame has plenty of stuff in there, right? It's got me almost flunking out of college. It's got all of the times that I've lost my cool with my kids. It's got more than one or two of the sermons that I have preached. It's got some of the just mean, spiteful things that I have said to other people. Right? And here comes God in the person of Jesus walking through the wing of my shame, room by room, and putting his hand on every single piece of furniture in there and saying, I see this. I understand it better than you do. And I love you anyway. And I forgive you. And I am going to bring you into the promised land. And then here comes God in the person of Jesus walking through the hall of my pride, which is pretty well furnished too, right? With working at a children's home and reading aloud to my kids and more than one or two of the sermons that I've preached and some of the really profound and compassionate things that I've said to other people. And Jesus goes through and he puts his hand on every one of those things. And he says, I see this, and I love you anyway. Not because, in spite of you putting your trust in this word or that decision, I love you and I forgive you and I'm bringing you into the promised land with me. You see how the character of God, the absolute mercy of God, sets us free from having to choose whether to be proud or ashamed of anything that we have done or failed to do. Sets us free to confess. I was a stubborn and rebellious kid who became a stubborn and rebellious teenager who conned a whole congregation into making me a stubborn and rebellious pastor. And God knew it. And he loves me anyway. And he forgives me. and he's bringing me into the promised land. And so I am free to confess. Confession sets us free, and confession makes us holy. Holy means distinct, different, set apart. God's people are not meant to go into the land and replace the people who've been living there and then just become like them. Right? They're meant to become different from them, but of course, not feeling superior to them. Right? So they're not to be different by being markedly more righteous and then inevitably, because we're human beings, pleased with themselves for being more righteous. They're meant to be made different by confession. By being a people who are free to admit that they're not righteous. That they need saving. This is every time in the history of God's people that we've actually managed to be something close to what God's intended us to be. It has been about confession. That is always what has made us holy. What makes the Old Testament, the history of Israel, stand out. There are lots of histories written down of peoples in that time and place. But all of the other histories are about how great and singularly amazing the Egyptians are, as the Egyptians saw it. Or the Babylonians were, as the Babylonians saw it. Only the Old Testament says, let us tell you all about how messed up we are and how remarkable it is that God would stick with us anyway. Right? And this applies in every circumstance. In the 1930s, in Germany, the Nazi Party really wanted the church on its side. And as far as anyone could tell in the world at that time, the Nazis were the winners. Right? There was serious debate going on in the United States about whether the day of democracy had ended and it would take strong national authoritarian governments to handle the challenges of the 20th century. Right? And so here comes this invitation. Get on the winning side. And most of the people who called themselves God's people said, yes, we accept. We like being on the winning side. Right? Catholics and Protestants got on board. And the small sliver of the German church that said no called themselves the confessing church. Not the really righteous church, not the wise enough to refuse to bow down to the powers of this age church, the confessing church will be the people who are about confessing the truth about God's character and about our character. The situation for the church in China in the 2020s is very different from the situation for the church in Germany in the 1930s. In Germany, the government wanted the church on its side. In China now, the government does not want the church on its side. The government wants the church to stop existing. And this has gotten a lot worse and more intense over the last 4 or 5 years, and particularly during COVID. And a number of the Chinese house church pastors during the COVID years made the decision to put their teaching online and make it publicly available because it was so hard for people to gather. If you did that as an American pastor, you were just hoping for more clicks and views. Right? If you did that as a Chinese pastor, you were mostly hoping for not the wrong clicks and views, because doing it could very easily lead to you being arrested or even executed. And one of the pastors who did this preached a sermon about withstanding the persecution, and he said, I'm not going to pronounce this right, forgive me. Guo Muyun, maybe, something like that. And he said, then, my number one hope and prayer for us is that we would stand out not by rebelling against the government, but by confessing our rebellion against God. But the thing we need most is not protection from persecution, but to stop relying on our own strength and be protected from self-righteousness. In every situation, we are to be a confessing people, a people freed by the merciful character of our God to acknowledge again and again and again how much we need mercy. That and only that makes us holy. So we try to practice this as a congregation, right? Most Sundays, if you're here, we have a confession that we do together. We're headed into the season of Lent, which in the church calendar is a time of confession. And we're going to, our plan for this year is to make Lent not the sort of corporate, abstract, let's all confess that we are sinners time, but to have particular people in the congregation come forward who are willing, not be manipulated into it, and confess their sin. So that like we can practice this being personal. Not just a few minutes on Sunday morning, but an all day, every day way of being God's confessing people. Of course, that can turn into a new way to be proud or shameful. Of course, that can turn into, isn't it great that we're a confessing church, not like all those other churches that don't have a confession every Sunday? Right? Or, isn't it shameful how many sins we've committed and how little we confess? But if that happens, we've missed the point entirely. Because the practice of confession is not just bracketed and contained by God's promises to stay with us. The practice of being a confessing people is powered by God being in the midst of our confessions and interceding for us. I skipped over almost all of the middle of our text until the end on purpose. I want to read you what Moses did in the midst of the people's sin. And end by, surprise of surprises if you're here regularly, showing how it points to Jesus. This is starting in verse 13 of chapter 9. This is after the people have thumbed their noses at God. "Furthermore, Yahweh said to me, 'I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stubborn people. Let me alone, that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven, and I will make of you a nation mightier and greater than they.' So I turned and came down from the mountain, and the mountain was burning with fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. And I looked, and behold, you had sinned against Yahweh your God. You had made yourselves a golden calf. You had turned aside quickly from the way that Yahweh had commanded you. So I took hold of the two tablets, and I threw them out of my two hands and broke them before your eyes. Then I lay prostrate before Yahweh as before 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water, because of all the sin that you had committed in doing what was evil in the sight of Yahweh to provoke him to anger." Moses, he comes down and he sees the sin of the people, and he feels the need to stand in between the sinful people and their righteous God and protect the people from God. And that doesn't sound like what I've been preaching. That sounds like God just wants to get rid of us and start over, because he said so, right there in the text. Right. But what you need to know is that this is a foreshadowing, a reverse echo of how God really saves us. So in this story, we have the righteous God who is rightly angry at our sin, and we have a sinful people, and then we have a human standing in between, trying to appease God's anger at sin and save God's sinful people at the same time. And it can't ultimately work because Moses is one of the sinners too. If you read Deuteronomy all the way through, which takes a while, one of the things you'll notice periodically is that Moses is a little bitter. And it's understandable, right? He's been leading this frustrating people through the wilderness for 40 years, been doing his best to take care of them, and they finally get to the place where they're going to see some success, they're going to start winning, and all the other people get to go into the promised land, and Moses isn't allowed. And if I'm in his shoes, I'm like, that's not fair. Moses has let pride creep in. If you just read this passage four times, Moses talks about fasting for 40 days and 40 nights on behalf of the people. Which, I mean, yes, impressive. If you mention it four times in 40 verses, you might be a little full of yourself. Like, this isn't true, I'm making this up, but if I just casually drop in that Monday's my day off and I spend it sitting on top of Chip Ross just praying for everybody all day long, that is not what I do. I take a nap. Right? But if I did the other thing and I kept telling you about it over and over and over again, you would be able to tell that the story has become kind of about me and how amazing I am. So Moses can't be the one who really appeases God's anger at sin and saves God's sinful people. That has to wait for another human being who went up on another mountain in the midst of God's stubborn and rebellious people, not to receive God's law, but to bear God's wrath. For another human being who had far more to be proud about than Moses did, and yet humbled himself to the point of death, so that he could save us. And because the answer to how God can hate our sin and yet love us is not Moses interceding on our behalf, but Jesus, who is God, interceding on our behalf, you can see that within God is the resolution of his anger at our sin and his love for us. Within God is the capacity to say, you are guilty, more guilty than you would ever know, and you need never be ashamed, because I find you worth saving, and I died to save you. The invitation Moses is offering to this generation, and to us, and to every generation, is to leave the architecture of our own souls behind and come and dwell in our Father's house that has many rooms. To come and be a part of a story that is not based on our righteousness, but on God's redemption. Not based on the intensity of our faith, but on the eternity of God's faithfulness. A place where you are free to admit all of the ways that you are guilty, because Jesus already took all of your guilt on himself and paid the price to win you to himself. That's the invitation. We get to be a confessing people, because God has said, confess. Ask me for mercy. I have already said yes. We're going to pray, and then we're going to enter into our usual practice of law and confession and assurance. And we're going to half sing our way through this reality that we are bounded by the grace of God, and that the mercy of God is welling up in the midst of our sin.